This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Tickets are going fast for the very first unregistered live event in Brooklyn on July 16th with Dave Smith and Nick Gillespie. To get your tickets, go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses. My guest this week has a simple but radical proposition to make. You cannot live your best life until you've prepared for your death. This is my interview with Tom Nichol. So about 3 years ago, I realized something. I realized that I was going to die. And when I say that, I mean that, of course, I knew intellectually my entire life that people die and I was a person. So I knew that I would die on some level of my consciousness intellectually. But I didn't feel it until I hit about 50 years old. And I really, really felt it. To the point where I would walk around and look at other people and think, why aren't they panicking the way that I'm panicking about the fact that we're all going to die? It hit me hard. At the age of 50, for a lot of people, that's when you sort of turn the corner and see that you've entered the last half or the final stage, in some sense, of your life. And it becomes real. You start to feel it. And I certainly felt it. And I've been feeling it for years now. And then I came across this person named Tom Nichol, who has devoted much of his life to studying death and dying, to teaching about it, to helping people through the dying process as a hospice worker, as a son, and as a friend. He's taught about death and dying, the end of life experience. He's become something of an expert in that field, although he would reject that label, although I believe that he is, because I have learned a tremendous amount from him about the end of life. And I have begun to prepare, because of his teaching and his friendship, for that thing. Although I've just begun this. Now, I've actually come all the way to Orcas Island in the San Juan Islands in Washington State, near the Canadian border, to visit Tom. In part because he's a great man who I've learned much from, but also because he'll be teaching a course on death and dying that is unique and I think will change people's lives, because it's already begun to change mine, and I've only just begun studying and doing the work on it. So I'm very glad to be here with Tom, who has a long history in many fields, not just in this. Goes all the way back to the 1960s. He's been doing a lot of things that I, myself, have sort of been doing recently in media, in podcasting. He's really an OG media pioneer. We'll get into that later. But recently, as I said, for many years, he's made himself into, I think, one of the most important people you can talk to about the end of your life. And he'll be teaching a course called An Instructional Guide for Dying for us very soon. So Tom, thanks very much for this. And I want to begin by talking about your first experiences with death and dying, which began before you were born, in a sense.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they count. Thanks for all that. It was really fun to listen to. And as I told you, my first near-death experience was right when I was being born. I'm 70 now, and I was born in 1948. I was born 10 weeks premature, which was pretty much a death sentence back then. And the doctor actually said, Mrs. Nichol, he's not going to make it. Fortunately, a nurse nudged my father. My father went off and found another doctor who found a way to keep me going, and I tricked them all and lived. Was in an incubator for a couple months, I guess, so it was a near thing. I don't know if that counts, you know, what you were just talking about in terms of a deeper, more real awareness in your 50s. You know, the technical term for that is mortality salience. The term salience means something becomes more real. It becomes meaningful to you in an actual way. And I guess, you know, I've thought about this. I think everybody thinks about their end of life, even when they're kids. It's surprising. And I bet you did when you were a kid, too, and you might not even remember that you did. But where it really became salient for me in my adult life was the death of my mother.
Yeah.
And my mother had been a hospice volunteer. So she had put the idea into my head that there is a role of people who help others in that transition. I was real close to my mother, and we talked about it, and I knew what it meant to her. And then when she had lung cancer and a stroke, and, you know, she was now nearing the end and was in a facility and did not want to die there. By the way, something like 85%, you can see different studies, the numbers don't matter, but the idea is true about, you know, 85% of people in America say they'd like to die peacefully and naturally in a comfortable place like their home. It turns out that maybe 10 to 15% actually end up that way. Wow. That's why we're talking today. That's why we're going to do a course. I mean, one message is, if you don't prepare and if you don't think about what you want and you just say, well, can I I'll just take what comes probably isn't what you want. It'll be, you know, you following an institutional sort of end, more like an object than a person that has a lot of agency and decision-making and whatnot. And my mom didn't want that. She knew what that was like. So she asked me to come take her out of the institutional setting, take her home and be with her while she died over a 2-week period, which we did. And man, it was just one of the really, really high points of my life. I still think about it a lot. When something really good happens to me, I still have the instinct that I want to share it with my mom. The fact that I was able to help her at that time, it just meant so much to me. And you know, I know lots of people, maybe they tried to be there when their mom or dad was going and they just couldn't make it on time. There's unfinished business there. And that's really important. I'll just say right now, if you think you needed to say something to your parents and you didn't quite make it or you weren't able to, you can still do it. You can get a picture of them and you can look at them and you can feel their presence there and you can say what needs to be said. So there you go. Fortunately, I was really able to be there and read Winnie the Pooh stories and, you know, just turn around in life. She had become in some ways a little infant and I took care of her. And then, not too many months after that, I got diagnosed with cancer. I was actually teaching at a Buddhist university at the time when I helped my mother. So if there's a better way to get yourself prepared to have a doctor tell you that you have cancer than be hanging out with Buddhists for a couple of years and then sort of help your mother through the transition, I don't know what it is, what it would be. And so when I did get that news back in 2007 that I had a form of cancer, and that's the real mortality salience there. I mean, someone that you love dies, it makes it real, as you're saying, but nothing like looking at a doctor saying you have cancer. And I've talked, this is kind of one of those moments in life, and I've talked to a lot of people, and my perspective was always that sometime off in the distant future, there's going to be this really hard thing I'm going to have to deal with. And then right when that doctor said it, I just immediately went, well, this is that hard thing. Now, here it is. You know, everybody doesn't feel that way, apparently. My wife doesn't. Her basic assumption was that she would just sort of go through life and everything would be fine. And sometimes she'd just sort of drift away. But I kind of figured there'd be something like this. And there was. But you know, I've used it. I was a patient at Kaiser at that time, and it was a Kaiser doctor that gave me that diagnosis. And you know, you get tests. It takes you a couple times, and one of the times I was there visiting, I noticed a sign on the wall that said, "Come and be a Kaiser Hospice volunteer." And this is what I need to do. You know, I knew I was now going to be, you know, personally walking down that path. I knew for my mom what it could offer. And so for the next 2-3 years, I have a blood cancer, a form of leukemia. And one good thing about blood cancers is they can take your blood and test it and find out that you've got it before you necessarily have to do anything about it. I think that's really huge, because if you have a cancer in an organ, usually the diagnosis and the treatment, it might only be days apart. And in my case, and in the case of a lot of people who have blood cancer, I had 3 years between diagnosis and treatment. And if you choose to use those years as a way to make the experience your own, you know, to really put your arms around it, I think it makes all the difference going into treatment. And that's what I did. I both put myself into, you know, the lives of many people who were at the end of theirs as a Kaiser Hospice volunteer, which was the form of hospice where you go into people's home and provide support for their family, the caregivers and whatnot, and just spend time with the dying person, which I did. I got a lot out of it. Maybe we'll tell stories about it later. We'll see. But to just give the quick outline for myself, I then did get chemo in 2010. And, you know, it was a very, very difficult experience, but with ginger ale and medical marijuana, because I was in California, it was, man, you go into the medical, it was just medical marijuana, then it hadn't been legalized recreationally. And when you'd go in there and you'd say, I'm a cancer patient, everybody, this, yes, that's what we're in business for, please, you know, what can we do for you? It was a really neat experience, and it certainly helped a lot. And I stopped hospice volunteering when I was doing my treatment. And then some number of months after that, I did a different form of hospice caregiving, which isn't going into someone's residence, but there's actually a kind of internationally famous hospice care facility was in San Francisco called Zen Hospice. It's associated with the San Francisco Zen Center. It goes back to the days of the AIDS epidemic, and it's just a pretty renowned institution with a Buddhist approach to end-of-life care. And my work with Kaiser was really meant a lot to me, but it was me going out on my own into people's homes and making these relationships. But, you know, I felt kind of like the Lone Ranger. I wanted to be part of a larger community of people who cared about these matters, to share it with them and whatnot. And that's what the Zen Hospice offered. There are volunteer caregivers who are really deeply and intensely trained through a process that they've fine-tuned and evolved over 20 years. And then, so there's a community of, like, you know, 100 or so of us around San Francisco, and we get to know each other by serving there together and by, you know, transitioning between the shifts, getting together and whatnot. So that was probably one of my most favorite parts of my San Francisco experience, was being part of that Zen Hospice community. And, you know, spending my shift Saturday nights. I did it for about 6 or 7 years. And my main shift was Saturday nights. So I, you know, stopped going out on Saturday nights and hanging out with dying people. And it was, many times I felt so great going home. It was, you know, better than a Saturday night event. You could have imagined the depth of what it feels like to be intimately close to someone at that point of life. And you form relationships very fast, because they're not kidding around anymore. So that was that. And then the one other dimension I'll say before I you know, take a breather is that I am an instructional designer. And so the natural thing, I think the best way to learn anything is to teach it to people. And so I'm actually an online course designer. And so at some point, right back at that early diagnosis time back in 2008, I think I started doing this. I decided, you know, okay, I don't know what's going to happen as a result of this, but I'd like to prepare myself for it. I was a philosophy major as an undergraduate in college. I'd read the famous, you know, dialogue by Socrates, the Phaedo at the end of his life, where he talks about the philosopher's task is to prepare for dying. But it's not that obvious where you get the handbook to help you prepare for dying. I, outside of a religious tradition that I wasn't part of one that told me how to prepare. So I decided I'll just start to dig in and see what I can build on my own. And I built over couple of years, my first version of an instructional design for dying. It's not the instructional design for dying. There's probably lots of ways people could come up with a curriculum of activities, information to take in, things that they could do that would have the effect of helping them feel better prepared for end of life, alleviating the death anxiety that we all carry around. I was also running a training program, a continuing ed licensure program for mental health professionals, counselors, psychologists, whatnot at that time. It was my last job at a university in San Francisco. So I was able to test my ideas of how you could do activities with people and would they find it helpful or not. And as I tested them in workshops, I'd then build it into the course. And I finished a full version of it. And people then took that and I learned from it. About 3 years ago now, I retired and kind of put the course on the back burner. It was all in great shape. I'd tested it. People had done it. But I hit the point of my life where I could actually travel some, and I wasn't in a position to get the really finish the course to be able to support it on an ongoing basis. I was just doing other things, and then Thaddeus Russell came along, and I was joined one of his Ask Me Anythings, and something came up about end of life. I mentioned that I had this course, and here we are talking about it now.
Yeah. It changed my life too, because when you said that in the course, I said, oh my gosh, we've got to talk when we've got to do this. So you make a couple of radical claims here, okay? And I think you're making a couple of, you're making some radical answers to, I think, what questions that many people would have at this point. You surrounded yourself with dying people. You volunteered to do that at the Zen Hospice Center and at the Kaiser Hospice, in the Kaiser Hospice program for many, many years. And you spent your Saturday nights when you were living in San Francisco, as you said, with dying people. Now, you've said a couple of things here about this. One, you've said that that made you happy. It was tremendously fulfilling. Rather than being in a nightclub or a bar or with some woman or something on a night, on a Saturday night in San Francisco, which is what a lot of people think you should do there, as I said, you sat next to the bed of people dying. And that is what you said has made you happier. It made you happy in a very deep way, it sounds like, number one. So that's going to be surprising and radical for a lot of people to hear. But I think it may be just the most important thing people could hear. Number two, and this might be actually even more important, is that you're saying that planning for one's own death, planning for your own death from the beginning of one's life, building it in to knowing that it's inevitable and planning for it like other things that are inevitable, right? Like graduations from high school. It's the same thing. You plan that, you think about it, you accept it early on and throughout your life, and you make specific plans along the way. You take specific actions all through your life, preparing for it. You are saying doing that, which is the opposite of what Americans do, which is the opposite of what most people in the West do, which is to ignore death. You're saying that to become more conscious of it, more deliberate about it, to address it directly on a regular, sustained basis throughout one's life will also make one happier. Is that right?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, you know, and the word that describes what you said is the more normal, normative attitude is denial. But the word denial itself means that you're not facing something that we all know is true, you know, kind of thing. I mean, denial isn't a positive term, but we all go around admitting that we do it. Another way that I put it is that I think that throughout our life, you know, Bob Dylan, anyone who's not busy being born is busy dying. From that point, we have a relationship with death. And you can choose to pay attention to that relationship, or you can choose to totally ignore it. And as we know, in all relationships, it's usually the ones you ignore that cause you troubles one way or another, all the way along the line, because there's the cognitive load of ignoring it, and then later on, because you didn't put in the time to nurture it and get things where they need to be. And so I've spoken, you don't find a lot of people that like to talk about death and dying. I do. And the word got around in the Bay Area that there's this guy that would do that. So for instance, I've spoken at high schools a fair amount, and you'd go, wait a minute, no. High school kids care about their date and making the football team, whatever it is. They do not care about this. They do. That you got to know the right way to talk to them. I kind of enjoy that. And you also need to know the way to get questions out of them. Because if you say, raise your hand, they're going to do it, you know, not in public. But when I finally realized that what you need to do is pass out little notepads and, you know, pencils, and that people can write down their questions as you're talking, if you can keep them engaged and, you know, sort of bring some real feeling and passion to it, and then pass up the questions, and they were full of questions and they didn't have anybody that they trusted, you know, to ask them. Questions like, how long does it take to die? Because death has now been removed from the reality of all our lives. Right. You know, does it hurt when you die? Do people bleed when they die? They don't know that, mm-hmm. you know? And so I just bring that up to say that at every point in our life, I believe we have a lot of questions, stuff going on inside us about what all this means. And if there's a way to form a relationship with death at that point in our lifespan, I think it's a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it turns out, another kind of example is, you know, people have their bucket list. Oh, there's all these things that I got to do. I got to climb the highest mountain in every continent and whatever it is. And if I don't check off all those things, you know, I'm not ready to go. When you're with people at the end of life, it turns out that the things that they need to do to feel ready isn't the long bucket list. It's really just a couple of things that are very finite. Often it has to do with making something right in a relationship that went wrong a long time ago and didn't get addressed, or this feeling that I've always had inside me of some attention, of an award that I deserve that I never got and I haven't been able to let go of that. You know, it's usually something like that. Mm. And all your life you might have tried to deal with it, but you sort of know in your head, this is different. I'm about to die now, you know? So maybe if I promise myself that I will talk to my sister now, maybe I'll actually do it, because now, you know, I can't get around about it anymore. Well, the point of that is that the thing that you want to do to make yourself feel ready at the end, that's actually what you want to do during your life too. It would have been better if you'd talked to your sister. You don't know, you might die tomorrow.
Right.
So maybe today is the day
that's
you
right.
should be talking to your sister to get that right. And right. when you do, you will feel better and it'll make your life now feel better. And this is kind of a cliche, but everything that you want to do to prepare for the end of life makes your life now freer and easier.
Mm-hmm. It can become an imperative to do things that are helpful, that we would call self-help. Now, at any point in our life, once we incorporate death as, or the dying experience as an imperative, something that we must take on, that we must take seriously in a rigorous way and in a daily way, ideally, that translates into stuff that we would consider to be self-help,
right.
or self-improvement or improving one's life. So like repairing or creating relationships that
right.
are meaningful. For instance, as you're saying, that I think most of us would agree is pretty central to a happy life. And, you know, how else though would preparing for life make me happier now? I'm preparing for death, I should say. Well, I guess that is. That was an interesting slip. That is exactly what you're saying, isn't it? That preparing for death is preparing for life, or preparing for death is living life.
That's, I'd say it more that way.
Yeah.
And here's another way. I break it down, kind of my introduction to how do you prepare for end of life is, I got this three levels: personal, interpersonal, and then society as a whole, social. And that personal, I think the real theme, I mean, I could talk for hours about all these things, but the real theme of the personal level of preparation is this notion of completeness. Not completeness like a bucket list, but like complete enough.
Yeah.
I got the important ones,
yeah.
you know. And again, because you don't know when you're going to die, about 2,000, maybe 2,200 people in America wake up every morning and they brush their teeth and they go through their rituals and they don't know that they're never going to do that again.
Wow.
I think it's about a 1 in 15 chance of a completely sudden and unexpected death from an accident, a cardiac arrest,
wow.
or something like that. And some people say that's how they want to go.
Yeah.
And it's kind of selfish. Maybe, I don't know what's a good idea and what isn't. None of us do. But if you do want to go that way, the real thing to think about is then the people left behind. And you don't have to worry about your incomplete stuff because you're not here anymore, but they do, you know, kind mm-hmm. of thing. Mm-hmm. Do you remember, what's his name from The Matrix?
Oh, which one? Neo?
Keanu Reeves.
Oh, yeah.
Just a couple of weeks ago, was all over the internet with a viral video. He was on a talk show and they said, you know, what do you think about end of life and dying and the meaning? And he said, well, I don't really know, but I know that the people left here are going to be sad.
Uh-huh.
he said it so well, and it went, and that's really, really true, you know. Mm-hmm. And thinking about them means like, well, you know, maybe it's my one in 15 days, so I'm just going to try to stay on top of things. You know, I don't have that deadline. Well, actually, maybe I do have that deadline, right? Okay. But you ask another way to look at it. So you kick it up now to the social level. One, if you figure out kind of the way that you'd like your end of life to go, I want to have all the techniques of modern science applied to my case. That's what I really want, you know, or I don't. I don't want any of those things, or I want some of them. I want help breathing, but I don't want you to force feed food down me, you know, whatever it is. You think about that. But just because you think about it doesn't mean it's going to happen. You guys have to talk to people about it. In fact, the single most important thing that you might do is pick someone to be your healthcare proxy, someone who will speak for you at a time when you're not really able to do that. And so that person has, you're not going to be able to say every eventuality that could happen, and they're going to memorize what to do. So they're going to have a deep understanding of you so that they can figure out, he didn't tell me what to do in this case, but I know Tom real well. Well, the point of that, that we don't have discussions about end of life very often. It's never the right time. I'd rather watch Netflix, you know, something like mm-hmm. that. Well, but when you do have that talk with someone that you feel close enough to be your healthcare provider, well, it builds another level of intimacy into your relationship right. with them. So that's another example of how your life now feels better because of how that relationship got deeper around preparing for your end of life.
Right. You know? You've also made me think about this differently in another way, which is basically the product of the last couple of days I've been spending here with you on this island. Is you and I have basically been just hanging out one-on-one. It's been an incredible experience, learning a lot about you and your life and learning from you about this. But, you know, I came to this island with a lot of anxiety about my own death, in part because of recent experiences with the podcast and other things that people may know about. I've been around death lately. I've been around people who have been around death lately quite a lot, and it's really seeped into me, and it's become really a problem for me lately. I have felt alone with it. I think that is the real problem for me, alone with it. Like, sometimes I felt like I was the only person dying, although I was one, and that because I was felt like, why is no one else around me freaking out that they're going to die? We are all going to die. Everyone's walking around as if it's no problem. But I felt like I was the only one with this issue until I hung out with you and started to feel just like you and others are there to experience this with me. There are people out there who can to do this with me. And then me helping others through that as well, it becomes a communal experience, a voluntary, let me underline that, voluntary communal experience, collective experience maybe even, or just a relationship with another person, one particular relationship with another individual, like with hospice care often, right? It's just you literally sitting next to someone on their deathbed, is it not, right?
That's right.
Sometimes just talking to them, singing to them, just touching them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's beautiful. A friend of mine once said, a very cynical person, he said, well, you know, we all die alone. He said, that's what it really is about. He was basically making an argument that you have to just look out for yourself all the time mm-hmm. because we die alone. That's what he said. And I believed him. And that's how I've been thinking too. This has been 20 years since he said that. It's been sticking in my head until I met you. And I don't think that's true. I don't think we have to die alone. And in fact, I'm going to make sure that I don't die alone. And I want to die with people around me like you and others who take this seriously, not in the way that Americans take it seriously, but in a way that is about a real bond between two people around acceptance, I guess.
Well, I'll take a step beyond acceptance,
yes,
too.
Please.
I mean, the common wisdom is like, oh, man, if I could only get to acceptance, I'd have it made. Mm. Actually, I'm going for appreciation.
Yeah.
I hit acceptance a long time ago, and I think, and we could actually sort of talk big picture political stuff here, because I think it's not only possible, but the more you think about it and the more you spend time in it, you actually do begin to appreciate the fact
wow.
That we're going to die and that we're mortal. And that gives us many benefits. And in the world today, denial has taken new forms. Mm-hmm. Ernest Becker wrote a book in the 1950s. It was a bestseller called Denial of Death. And he talked about the things that we do to hold back and tamp down our own death anxiety as the driving force of all civilization. Yeah. The reason that we do anything is an immortality project to distract us from the reality of the situation.
Right.
And everybody's kind of familiar with that way of looking at it. I think we're in a new form of denialism now, which is the scientific life extension by either reversing, halting, slowing biological cell death, or by the notion of cyber immortalizing mm-hmm. ourselves mm-hmm. In the cloud or something like that. I see those as forms of denial. I understand the impulses that drive those. And I wouldn't even say to people, you know, stop doing it, I guess, if that's what they need to do. I guess I would also encourage them perhaps to consider other alternatives at the same time. Maybe their project isn't going to work out, and you know, maybe a plan B, you know, would be a good idea. And so I'll say a few more things about how I think preparing for what I appreciate about the human condition, the fact that it does have an end. I want to say one more important thing. This is really in a practical matter. If one person hears this, it's worth it. You know, when I talked about a healthcare proxy, probably most people thought about their partner or their best friend if they're not living with a partner. But I think the most important social interaction around your own preparation is if you have children to talk with them. Hmm. And it's the hardest by far. For one thing, no matter how sophisticated and smart and grown up, even how old your kids are, they probably don't imagine you dying. They don't. It's the last thing that they want to talk about, no matter what their relationship is with you. But it's crucial for a lot of reasons. And the main one is that if there is a single thing that subverts people's wish about how they want to go at the end, it's the kids subverting them actively, competing with each other to see who can show their love for mom and dad the most by doing things that aren't necessary, have nothing to do with what mom and dad needs and everything to do with what the kid needs from their mom and dad and, you know, didn't get finished. A typical thing that you see is there's the sibling in the hometown where mom or dad is, yeah, who's been doing all the childcare. Then the sibling comes from out of town. They've been out of touch and they've got to go overboard, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. What? Mom hasn't been eating? I'm going to make sure she eats. No, mom mm-hmm. doesn't want to eat, you know, mm-hmm. kind of thing. So at a very practical level, it's important to talk to your kids. If they subvert your wishes, well, did you talk to them about your wishes? Did you make sure they knew what you wanted? You know, mm-hmm. So there's that. And then at a practical level, but then just the act of talking, no matter how difficult it seems that it's going to be, when you're through having that talk with your kids, it's really an amazing, you're almost crying together and, yeah, and hugging. It's just one of those kind of moments, you
yeah.
know? So,
yeah, that's it. Yeah. So I was in deep, what do you call it? Mortality salience?
Is that, well, you became, yeah, to be really aware of the concreteness of it. Yeah,
my mortality became salient. Yeah, there you recently. Go. I mean, yeah, especially salient, really. Yeah. I think this is probably true for a lot of people who hit 50, right?
Uh-huh.
You see, yeah, it's sort of the turning point. You see the second half of your life, or very clearly. But so I was sort of flailing about, right? Because I was an American. We don't talk about death. And I was suffering from this that Americans suffer from. Then I went to Mexico, right? And I learned a bit more about the Day of the Dead. And I loved the idea of it, that the dead come back once a year to visit. Mm-hmm. It's just a beautiful idea, right? And now as a postmodernist, I can say, well, it's a fiction, but it's a fiction like any other fiction. And so I started to think, I like that. I like the Day of the Dead idea. And I also like the sort of idea of reincarnation, you know, which, you know, both I would put under the category of superstition, religious superstition. I see no evidence for it. I could never, ever prove it. I strongly doubt it's true, but I really like it. I like the ideas of coming back either annually to visit my loved ones as myself or coming back as an eagle soaring through the air, something like that, right? So I thought, well, since I'm a postmodernist and I don't believe anything is necessarily true and that all narratives are essentially as true as any other narrative, I thought, well, maybe I can just convince myself on some level of consciousness that reincarnation and or the Day of the Dead idea are actually true, and I'll just sort of live for the rest of my life with those ideas that I might come back as an eagle or I might revisit my loved ones on a regular basis annually until I hung out with you, as I was saying. And it's not that you said this to me, but it became clear. I mean, your message is, that's all fine if you want to do it, but you're saying that build it into your life, build your death into your life. The way you build other things into your life that you know are coming, like taxes and retirement. Yeah,
build the fact of death.
Build the fact and build it in so that it's part of your life from the beginning. And again, the Mexican culture, I think that's part of that. That's one of the reasons I love the sort of, it's not just the Day of the Dead, but it's, there's less fear about death and there's more acceptance of it, or it just is more part of regular life. So small children and teenagers and people of all ages participate in the Day of the Dead.
That's right. And you're saying it just right too. And because it's the behavior, it's the doing it. I think there's value to sitting around reading, Platonic dialogues about the end of Socrates' last days. But as you say, getting it into your life the way people would participate in activities around a death theme at Day of the Dead, but also, and just to give a sneak preview of how I've kind of structured this course, reason I said at the beginning that I'm not an expert in end of life is, first of all, it would be tough for anyone to say they are, but also there's lots of people out there that have spent their whole professional careers focusing on an aspect of end of life, and they know a gazillion times more about it than I'm ever going to, from funeral directors to a new occupation called death doulas. You could say that my hospice training makes me maybe a junior varsity death doula, but there's people that just do that, as a career, and they have a deeper feel for it than me. So the way that I approached it wasn't that I'm going to gather all of this content and expertise and then put it out there. There is content and there is expertise in the course that we're going to be offering. But I think what distinguishes it, what I really wanted to do was, in the way we're talking about it now, was to think about death as this thing that's going to be happening. It's part of our life at all the time, and we can be better at it. Mm-hmm. We can be better at handling the fact of it. That is to say, reduce the anxieties that come from it. And we can be better at having a good experience, a good death, when the thing actually comes. So I see dying as a skill, and I tried to make a skill development course. And a lot of what you do in the course isn't sit back and listen to smart people talking. It's I give you ideas of things to do with instructions and guidelines and templates that have you out going to cemeteries and then taking pictures of some of the things that sort of pop out to you, and then making maybe a slideshow out of those pictures and narrating that slideshow and talking about what were the aspects of that that kind of spoke to you, and then being able to share that with other people who are also trying to figure out this stuff and see what they did. Now, that sounds good. Go to a cemetery, make a slideshow. But when you do lots of that stuff, that's what it means to put it into your life. It's the behavior and the doing of it that starts to get you into it.
So, yeah. And it's also, I guess you could call it exposure therapy in a sense, right?
It is exactly.
So it becomes
that.
Less and less scary.
Precisely
the more,
that.
Okay. The more not just look at it and experience it, but integrate it into your life.
Right. And the essence also is great. You said exposure therapy is that these are done according to a careful program. You start with things, exposure therapy helps vets reduce their PTSD from being in Iraq, but you don't put someone the very first time into a VR simulation of, a bombing of a city. You very slowly, carefully get them exposed to it. And that's what we're trying to do in the course. Yeah. We'll do things that aren't really intimate and challenging at first, but sort of get your juices flowing. But by the end, we'll be talking in great concrete detail about the physical aspects of dying, what those decisions that you might want to face in those very last days or weeks or whatever it comes down to. But we work our way up to that.
I have a feeling this is going to be the most important course we have in our catalog. I really do.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see.
It'll be great.
We'll see. So I'm in Seattle with a new friend of mine. For many years, as many of you know, I've been struggling with this issue of environmentalism and what to do about it, and being constantly annoyed by environmentalists and feeling basically hassled by them to do a lot of things that I find to be uncomfortable and unpleasant for no apparent reason. But I met this guy, Paul Gamble, in Seattle, who's the head founder and CEO of this new company called Nori, and we sat down the other day and talked about it, and I thought it was important enough to bring him to you, the listeners of Unregistered, to find out about this new alternative, I think, that he's offering in solving the environmentalist crisis, or the environmental crisis, especially the climate change crisis, if there is one. Now, he believes there is one, first of all. So Let's talk, Paul. Where are you from? How did you get to this? Why do you care about the Earth? Because your politics otherwise are not terribly friendly, would not be seen as being friendly to environmentalism.
Yeah, I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. My family's from California, and I live in Seattle now. So I'm a person of the West, and I really value being outside. That's why I like living in Seattle, all the nature around us. And, you know, I want to make sure that I can still go skiing in the winter in 50 years.
You really think that's a problem? You think that's a threat?
I do. Yeah. I'm concerned by the amount of carbon dioxide that is in the atmosphere and that we're continuing to put up. That to me is like that's the real like crux of the problem, is there are just too many greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
Okay. So you're not a big fan of the left-wing politics, left-wing environmentalism at all.
No, not at all.
Right. So, but you do believe with what many climate change scientists are saying though.
I do. Yeah.
Okay. So what you're doing is you're trying to bring your politics, which we can call sort of libertarian-ish.
Market-oriented.
Market-oriented to this problem. So what is this company you founded, and what is the alternative you guys are offering?
So Nori is a carbon removal marketplace. Hmm. The way that we look at it is, if the problem is that there are too many emissions up in the atmosphere, then the solution is to pull those emissions back out. And if we can find ways to create new value in that process so that there's a financial incentive for people to do so, then they'll voluntarily do it. We'll have new entrepreneurs, new businesses entering that space and end up cleaning up the atmosphere and making money while doing so.
Yeah, removing it from the atmosphere. So what is this? How is it removed?
So there are a lot of different ways. We think of them in terms of ecological and industrial kind of buckets. So on the ecological side, changing farming practices can pull carbon out and store it in soils. You could plant trees or grow kelp. That's why we called our company Nori. Hmm. On the industrial side, we're building enormous amounts of new buildings all around the world. And if we can start putting CO2 into construction materials, so there are carbon negative cements or using sustainable timber to build wooden skyscrapers.
Oh, wow.
And then the one that really got me excited about this like 4 years ago is the process called direct air capture. So there are a number of different startups that have been invested in by the oil and gas industry that are pulling air in, they're separating the CO2 from the other gases, and then they can use that CO2 to manufacture products, or you can store it in underground rock formations where it will mineralize and turn into rock.
Wow. And so you're basically creating a market for these kinds of processes, right?
So all of these things exist today, but they're not happening at any scale. And meanwhile, corporations especially are clamoring to pay for carbon removal. When we talk to sustainability officers at companies, they're excited about going beyond carbon offsetting, which is just avoidance. It's saying like that we're reducing our emissions, but we're still emitting. They want to do carbon removal. They want to actually clean up the garbage that we've been throwing out on the street for the last 120 years. Hmm.
Either voluntarily or because the state is making them.
Right. Yeah. And so there are a lot of industries that are doing this voluntarily. And then there are some that are being forced or required to do it, like airlines internationally. But And that's going to continue to evolve over the next 10 to 50 years.
Okay. So tell us how the process that Nori works is going through. So you create certificates and you create tokens. So explain that.
Yeah. So this is a blockchain-based marketplace. And that's because there's been a lot of fraud and double counting in the existing carbon markets. And no one trusts them. And they don't survive very long. So we're using the blockchain to record whenever someone removes CO2 through any of those different means that we talked about. And then it gets verified by an independent verifier. And then we issue to them a carbon removal certificate. Each one is one metric ton of CO2 removed. And then they can sell that certificate through our platform to a buyer, like a corporation or an airline or a utility or something like that. And that utility or corporation is going to pay the remover one Nori token per ton of CO2 removed. So that the Nori token is like a medium of exchange, and that can become the reference price. So whenever you hear people talking about what is the price of carbon, what is the cost of it, no one really knows, and they're mostly just making it up. But when our market is up and running, you can look at the Nori token and say, that's the price of carbon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is interesting and very intriguing to me because it's voluntary. It's not the government or a network of governments internationally forcing people to do this, right?
Yeah.
You've created an incentive to remove carbon from the atmosphere.
Right. And people, if different people can make money off of this, then we think that one of the big advantages of this model is that you get rid of that solution aversion that people on the right tend to feel more often about climate change. That it's this idea that if you don't like the solutions that are being presented, then you kind of start subconsciously pushing back against that problem even existing in the first place.
Right.
But if the solutions are viable so that everyone can create new wealth and value for each other, and we can clean this up at the same time, mm-hmm. then why not do it that way?
Yeah. So if you believe that climate change is a serious problem, as Paul does, and I'm on the fence on this, but I'm persuadable. If you do believe it's a serious problem, this, I think, is the way to go, or this kind of thing is the way to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you're incentivizing it. You're making it a win-win proposition instead of asking everyone to sacrifice by doing all these various things like use compost toilets and drive cars that we don't want to drive. And
We can innovate our way out of this. Technology will be the solution to this. And I very much believe in still taking advantage of the things that like fossil fuel based energy gives us, like that's improved the human condition. We should keep doing that, but we should also clean up the carbon emissions that we've already put up there.
Cool, man. I like it. Everyone check out Nori.com. Is that right?
Nori.com.
Right. Named after the seaweed.
That's right.
That's going to change the world. No, your company's going to change the world. So Nori.com, and you also have a podcast or more than one podcast.
Yeah, right? We have two podcasts. There's a longer form one called Reversing Climate Change, and we interview different people in the space. So these could be like farmers and ranchers or sustainability officers, academics and researchers. And then the other one is called Carbon Removal Newsroom. It's a short form, usually about 10 minutes, and it's interviewing people about the latest current events about carbon removal and the things that are happening in that industry.
Great. Yeah, everyone go there. Nori.com, check them out. And if you want to change, if you're concerned about climate change, but don't want to do it the way you've been told to do it, want to do it in a different way, a better way, this is it. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Thad.
So I think I said can introduce the idea of preparing for end of life with that kind of three-part breakdown of personal and social. And the third level is societal. And just back to your example of how preparing for end of life can, add something to your life right now. Societal means that, just because you've figured out how you think you might want things to go, and of course that might change, you've got to stay on top of it, and you've talked to the people that really matter in your life about it, society still demands that you get it down a certain way. Mm-hmm. Probably the best known type of document is what they call an advanced care directive, where you really unpack all of your thoughts about how you'd like things to go, and you can do it from scratch. There's national organizations that have created templates for that. And then there are other kinds of documents beyond that that actually stipulate what physicians can and can't do. That's what I mean by kind of the legal society level. And some of those, the physician's orders aspects, you need to talk to your doctor about it. That's another kind of conversation. I mean, usually you sit there and you listen to the doctor and they tell you what's going on and you ask a few, but you don't have a talk about how I want things to go, mm-hmm. And doctors aren't, some doctors are not all that comfortable with it either. But once again, the act of having those conversations, getting those documents prepared, really provides a sense of relief. Hmm. There's no guarantee about anything in life. Just because you go through all that process, you still don't know what's going to happen. But the fact that you put that effort in, you've made the best chance that you can at taking that all the way through to the end, for almost anyone I've ever talked to about it, is relieves anxieties. Hmm. So,
yeah. Tell me about the Zen Hospice Center in San Francisco, where you volunteered for many years on Saturday nights. What was it that was Zen? How is it different than other hospice programs?
Well, interesting. And the only one I know in detail, of course, is Kaiser. And so there's a couple of things about it. Zen Hospice is pretty well known. It's been studied. There's been, you know, academic journals about it. And so one thing is that I was trained at Kaiser, but I was trained in how to interact with other dying people. At Zen Hospice, it starts with training on yourself. Buddhism has attitudes about life and death. And there is a Buddhist, you don't have to be a Buddhist to volunteer at Zen Hospice, but you have to go through a training process that's founded on a Buddhist ideology of getting clear in your own mind about your mortality, not just coming to accept it, but perhaps being able to appreciate it. So there's quite a training program. It starts with yourself. Then there's all sorts of role-playing and simulations of being with other people that you really, you know, get deeply involved in. But that, I think that starting with yourself and your own attitude about a death and dying is something I don't know if it happens at other hospices. I haven't seen it. We have also rituals that we do. There's three shifts during the day, and two caregivers work each shifts. And when you come early before your shift starts, and the people who are finishing stay a half an hour late, and you meditate together. And then after that meditation, the people who have been there just kind of say what that shift was like for them, and the people who are coming say what they're bringing. And it is all part of creating a community, but that group meditation is a Buddhist practice. There's no stipulation as to what form of meditation you use, but you know, it doesn't matter. And I guess there are there's principles of how we try to help the individuals who are in our care there through their process, and that all are based on, you know, on Buddhism. A being in the, you know, as we enter the room where the dying person is, we are going to be, we think of ourselves as leaving behind everything else and sharing that present moment just between myself and that person. It's a very mindful being in that moment and only in that moment. And that's how you're able to read in such a subtle situation. What does this person want? I mean, it's not obvious when there's someone just sitting there and unresponsive. Do they want you to make noises and talk and coax them into conversation or just touch their skin or nothing, not just to know that there's a human presence there? Well, it's only by being really sensitive to the moment and what you can read about that person that you have any chance of, you know, doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that Buddhist sense of presence is also part of it. Yeah, there's probably other aspects too, but maybe there's a start on it.
Yeah, death is in the future, and Buddhism attacks the future in a sense, or it lets the future go.
Yeah, I would say it that way. Mindfulness meditation is very popular in the West now, and the essence of mindfulness meditation is to be here in the present mm-hmm. moment with the things that are in the present moment. Mm-hmm. If you're meditating and you're meditating on the breath, it doesn't mean there's going to be lots of other things in the present moment than your breath, and you're trained in meditation to just notice those things. Notice that that thought came up, don't get engaged in it, go back to the breathing. Well, same type of thing, you know, other things come into your mind. I mean, I've just sat there for 2, 3, 4 hours just with my hand next to someone else who didn't say a thing that you know, the whole time. Well, of course, it's like a meditation. Other thoughts came into my mind. I wondered what I was going to do when I got home. I was thinking about the basketball game, you know, whatever. But notice that and get back to where I am, mm-hmm. you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to pause for you. Go for it. Go.
I guess if I was going to, you know, make any other comments about the kind of the Buddhist nature of Zen Hospice Project, I would go into the history, and that literally, it's hard to remember this now, but in the 1980s, San Francisco was one of the epicenters of the AIDS epidemic, and we didn't understand it. No one knew what was going on, and people were literally dying on the streets, and nobody would help them. Okay. It was in response to that Buddhists at the San Francisco Zen Center said, we need to do something. And that Buddhists don't just sit around meditating. Buddhists also are socially active people. This was an activist impulse to reach out and help other people that started Zen Hospice in the first place.
So, yeah, I didn't know it was in response to the AIDS crisis.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
So you're in the present with a person who's dying. We know they're dying, but it does let go of the future. You're letting go of the future and you're focusing on the present. You're living in the present.
That's right.
Even though you both know that the other person will be dying.
Right.
And that is liberating, I suppose, in a sense, or comforting, or it's neither. It's about simply living in a different space.
Yeah, and it gets things out of the present moment that you don't need to be there now so that you can really attend to what you do need to be attending to. Yeah. It's, you know, you and I were talking earlier, and you were anticipating some future disaster that might happen in a relationship.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, maybe that's going to happen, maybe not, but what you've done right now is taken a possible future thing that might happen and brought it into the present moment. We were having a really good present moment that didn't need to be then, you know, kind of thing. So it's that way of looking at it.
Yeah, as I've said many times in this podcast, I tend to live in the future and the past, which is exactly what mindfulness tells you not to do, or at least has made strong suggestions to me that I would be happier if I don't.
But we know it's going to happen. We know you're going to have thoughts about the future all the time in the present moment. Notice it and go back to where you are.
Okay.
It's not like you kick yourself for thinking about it. Just notice it, but don't get engaged in it.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, with death, as we've discussed earlier, Americans, and I'd say Westerners in general, Europeans and Americans, you know, we tend to deny it. We tend to not think about it.
Right.
So we actually don't live in the future very often in that way around death, but occasionally we're forced to, right? When we find out about death or someone near us dies, like with your mother, right? And then we confront it and we're unprepared.
Right.
For it. And when we are unprepared for it, we meet it with essentially panic, I think. And panic will cause us to either do something that's self-destructive or out of anger, or it'll cause us to withdraw from the thing itself. And we'll sort of repress it and put it away in our minds. I think that's sort of what goes on with most of us, right?
Yeah. Another common thing that you'll see would be, you know, someone in their 50s, maybe they were brought up in a certain religious tradition. They've kind of moved away from it in their adult life. And then their sister-in-law dies suddenly and unexpectedly. Then that was a mortality salience event. Mm-hmm. And so one thing a lot of people do is go back to the religion that they were brought. I need a source of comfort and solace and with some people that have answers about some of these questions that I hadn't been thinking about.
Right.
And that could be a good thing to do or a bad thing to do. I don't know. But that's another reaction that you see a lot.
Yeah. Can we get into your life history a bit here? Because it's full and a lot of it has little to do. Well, actually, I think a lot of it has to do with this, as a matter of fact, but it's hard to suss out until we talk through it, I think. But so you were born in 1948. Yeah. And you, as you said, you were born, what was it? How many weeks premature?
10 weeks premature.
10 weeks premature.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, you know, 1 pound, 14 ounces.
Wow.
Yeah. Really a preemie, super preemie.
And you were supposed to die.
Yep.
The doctors were assuming you were going to die.
Mrs. Nickel, he's not going to make it.
Yep. Your parents were assuming you were not going to die, but you did. You lived. You lived anyway. And you lived in a home with many generations, right?
Yeah. The first 3 or 4 years of my life was me, my parents, my grandparents, and my great grandparents. So I'm an only child and an only grandchild also. And also my great grandparents were there, and that's who I spent most of my time with for my first, you know, 3 or 4 years was my great grandparents.
And you were very close with your great grandfather?
Yeah.
And he died when you were 6.
So he would be my first remembered adult death, yeah.
So, I mean, it struck me when you told me this story, you know, that you were, that death and dying was sort of a part of you from birth, in a sense. And you were, you know, and you were considered to be, what did you say about, you were the...
Well, you can just
see the miracle child.
It was a miracle. I mean, they said I was going to die. I didn't. And there's all these four generations just kind of looking at me, you know, kind of things.
And then you lived from the beginning of your life with people who were essentially were beginning to die, right? And you experienced the death of your great grandfather, who you were very close with at an early age, right?
And you know, it is worth pointing out what you're saying though, too, because you know, one thing that's obviously happened in, you know, the world, at least in America today, is that a lot of people don't live in those extended families. So yeah, I think it was an incredible good fortune my part to know my grandparents and my great grandparents really well by living with them. So yeah.
Right. And you were very close with your mother, right? And you talked about how when she died, that was one of the most important moments and most fulfilling moments of your whole life.
Unquestionably.
Helping her through that.
That's
what began your career essentially in this field.
Shortly after that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really remarkable. And how the fact that you were diagnosed with cancer the year after her death is just remarkable.
Pretty amazing. Yeah.
And so since what's now 13 years.
So all that sequence, my mother 2006, my diagnosis 2007. Yeah.
Great part of your life has been focused on this and you've made yourself into, I'm going to say it again, an expert in this field and a teacher mostly, I think. But so you So you also, one of the reasons we're friends and one of the reasons I find you fascinating is your history prior to all this, and, or I should say in between your childhood and your recent career as a teacher on this. So you did discover death in a new way when you went to college. You went to college at Haverford, a Quaker, sort of hippie at the time, very anti-war, countercultural place. You entered Haverford in 1966. Mm-hmm. Now, 1966, there was a lot of death going on in the world, and you were very concerned with this. By 1970, there was even more death in the world, and you were even more concerned with it. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I was going to tie into the themes, but you're right. I mean, the signal event, the 60s for a lot of people began in about the fall of 1966. Mm-hmm. The super escalation of the Vietnam War was really 65. So being a student, an undergraduate as I was, you know, meant that I was going to make it through 4 years without having to worry about that stuff. But we all worried about it, and we all knew plenty of people that did go off to Vietnam. And it was a crazy time. I think that students really have to study a lot more now. I did my homework, I studied, but anti-war activism took up a lot of time, and it was a big part of what was going on then. And you know, it all through the 60s it built. And but as you say, the spring of 1970 was a signal time, not only in America but in the whole world. That was what we call the Kent State Cambodia event. Mm-hmm. It was when the secret Nixon's secret bombing of Cambodia was made public by Nixon. I think it was like in April 1970, and it was probably the biggest student uprising of outrage and protest that you know we'd seen up to that time. And that was when then four National Guardsmen fired on students at Kent State, and National Guardsmen, and killed four students at mm-hmm. Kent State, and Jackson State as well, the historical black institution. And so that things went even crazier. And it really seemed that, to put it in historical context, there was left-wing, very well-organized political factions taking control of large hunks of Paris. They were running around London. It was the height of the Red Guards doing, we couldn't even comprehend what they seemed to be doing in China. So it seemed like the existing institutions of society were really coming apart at the seams. So if you want to talk death, I mean, yes, there was the death of our peers in Vietnam. There was all the Vietnamese that we were killing. There was the Cambodians that weren't even supposed to be in the war that were getting bombed. But in some ways, it kind of seemed like it was the death of an old world, an old way of doing things. Well, that old world turned out to have a lot more legs than we thought it would, and they were still around. But graduating that fall, it just seemed crazy to, you know, continue to invest in that society and go on to law school or whatever the heck I might have done if I'd graduated in some other year. But so instead, myself and my closest friends went up to Boston, and a lot of the alternative change the world anti-war activism for many people changed into a new media form of self-expression. Sony put out the first affordable, a regular old person could buy it and use it video that they called the Sony Portapak in 1970. And a lot of alternative people just bought it, and they were going to start to document it. And now it not just a very few broadcast outlets can tell stories, you know, we can start to tell stories. And there was a very active alternative media scene up in Boston and Cambridge, you know, that I was part of. And we discovered what was then called cable TV. We now think of as broadband. We spent some time trying to help communities understand that pole space and conduit space is their local resource, that they could make their own locally owned, high capacity, interactive communications technology and not depend on some big company that would end up taking the money out of town.
Through cable, you're talking about.
Yeah.
Early 1970s, yeah. You saw that people had the ability through cable. There was cable already being laid?
In isolated rural areas, cable was already around, and there was the first wave of urban cable franchising in the early 70s. Yes, right. So people were knocking on the doors of big cities saying, give us a license to build a cable system in your city, and it was going to be worth millions, and the money was going to leave Boston and New York and Chicago and all these cities. And we figured out, we actually got into simulation modeling and determined that in a lot of American cities with the big population and the density, you could actually have neighborhood cable systems that would be economically viable, but then could connect with each other for citywide networking. There's so many creative ways broadband could have gone. And we did, you know, we were young and naive, and we did workshops and we wrote some books and we, you know, talked to people about our perspective. We were called communists and, you know, don't you know that municipalities can't run things, only private corporations can. And, you know, we were, you know, pretty young. But it was a great learning experience, and I think we put some good ideas out there. In 1973, it's hard to remember now, was the first of the Aramco initiated oil embargoes, and my numbers aren't exactly right, but it's something like gas went from, you know, the 30 cents a gallon, which it had been forever, to like over $1 a gallon, and that was a major freak out. Capital markets dried up, the urban cable franchising thing stopped for a number of years, and our little enterprise was kind of high and dry. So it was I've had a very episodic career, and that was then the end of that episode.
Yeah, but in the early 70s, for that time, you said you were at the center of the counterculture, certainly
of an aspect of the culture, yeah. The alternative media.
Yeah, I mean, right. So you, again, this is a reason I think, you know, I really enjoy hanging out with you and kind of honored to, frankly, because you're really a pioneer of essentially what I'm doing. I mean, this is what I'm doing is new media, but you were doing new media first.
Good way of looking at it. Yeah. I mean, not that we're doing it first, but there's a continuity to it.
Well, absolutely. Kind of. I mean, yeah. You were. I mean, there was nothing but the monopolies at the time.
That's
there was
right.
Nothing but the state sanctioned monopolies, the three networks and PBS and then the radio stations all had FCC licenses, and you couldn't really get in. You couldn't break in essentially to any of that. You saw that. I when you told me this, I couldn't believe it, that there was people, that there was cable in the early 1970s, and that you and others were thinking about the social possibilities of this. I guess you were thinking about sort of local TV. Is that what it was? Not the internet. Or are you thinking about communications generally?
Oh, no, the whole thing. Anything. Yeah, broadband. Yeah.
Wow. So even the early 70s, you were thinking basically about what the internet became.
Right. That's what I mean by broadband. We wrote a book called Cable in Boston that proposed six different full broadband franchises, subdividing Boston into different systems. Each would be not only economically viable but profitable. Then they would all be interconnected within each other. But a lot of that channel capacity would be about people in those neighborhoods using it for their personal uses, for their neighborhood uses, all that stuff. Yeah, that could have happened. Maybe it still could.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, it sort of is.
Yeah.
But you know, many years later. But you guys had that idea in the early 1970s. Right. I mean, it's really visionary. You were part of this thing called the Chapel Street Community. Is that right?
Yeah, this I talked to you about. This it's an informal designation, yeah. but yeah. So I lived and also worked in a really interesting suburb of Boston. It's called Newton, and it's along the Charles River, and it's where some of the very first factories in America were built. Mm-hmm. Lowell was part of it, but just down the Charles there into Newton was some very early factories. They built thread and made uniforms for the Union Army in the Civil War there. Mm-hmm. And at some point, those factories went out of the thread business, and they became empty for new people to come in and build new businesses. And that's where we put our new media stuff. And there was other kind of alternative people doing workshops about what we were then calling the consciousness movement, about meditation or about the healing power of crystals, or you know, some of the things that we had workshops on are still around today. Some we just kind of smile at because it was a fad of the time, you know, and the whole group of little small alternative businesses in there, yeah, we would do things like every couple months have a salon and invite people we knew to come in and talk about high-minded ideas or whatnot. So yeah, we envisioned that we were building an alternative community. We were supporting ourselves off of our media stuff. We were trying to put good ideas out into the culture by inviting others to events, that kind of thing. And we had a really good run through most of the 70s doing that. Yeah,
I mean, I put you in within the new left, capital N, capital L. Mm-hmm. And what a lot of people don't understand about the new left, the left of the 1960s, is that it was really divided in two. There were two halves to it. And if people want to see this, you can see it in the movie Berkeley in the 1960s. Yes, it's about my hometown, but it is quite instructive, I think. In that film, they show that there were really, at least in the Bay Area, two parts of the new left. One was the part that my parents were involved in, which was the hardcore political left, the socialists, the communists, and they all belonged to political parties or organizations that were primarily or entirely focused on things like economics and institutions and revolution and taking over factories and taking over the government. You know, hardcore political, standard political stuff. Then there's another new left that was going on simultaneously, which we sort of call the counterculture.
Right.
More sort of in San Francisco, around Haight-Ashbury, hippies, beatniks, all that. And out of that came a lot of changes in our culture, as you said, that were still around. I mean, the hippies and that whole countercultural movement had a lasting impact on us. Some of it became silly new age stuff, which I think you guys were sort of involved in, part of what you were involved in. Yep. Some of it became enduring, like meditation, and that I believe in fully with my heart is a healing thing, is a good thing. Simply the way we carry ourselves in the world was changed by your generation and what you guys are doing. We broke down gender boundaries and stereotypes so that it became easier to be a man or a woman with different, you know, behaviors and different interests, all those things. And I, of course, have become basically an opponent of the political wing of the 1960s movement, New Left, but I have always been have had affection and affinity for the countercultural wing of it. So when I met you, there's another thing that was very exciting to be, you're the first person, I just told you this yesterday, I think, when we were picking raspberries on the farm here, you're the first person I've gotten to know well, who is a member of the countercultural wing of the New Left. I've known all the Trotskyists and socialists and Maoists from that time, but someone who was really part of this countercultural movement, which was really interested in teaching people or offering people new ways to live in their daily lives differently, right? And I really appreciate that. And I think it's what's really made life better for people, as opposed to all those little political organizations that my parents were involved in, which did nothing for anyone, essentially, in my view. Right.
Yeah. No. Well, thanks for saying that. And I agree. I think it's well said. I'm not sure I'd quite even seen it that clearly. I had known that I made a clear choice. Starting after the Kent State and Cambodia big political uprising, that probably wasn't gonna be a political guy. Mm-hmm. That I was gonna be a media guy. I love making digital media more than just about anything. So it was natural. But yeah, I think you're right. And I think that what I'm really trying to do now with instructional design for dying and that kind of stuff is in a way a continuation of trying to change the culture in certain ways and breaking down old ways that America had been for a long time and looking at it in a new way. So yeah.
And it's both individual and collective or something like that. I mean, it's, you're really focused on the individual, helping the individual with their own life, like sitting next to the person while they're dying and at their deathbed, right? That's one person and another person. Right. But it's also a model to be emulated and that has spread. And, you know, meditation, mindfulness, Zen, it is spreading like wildfire, thank God, in the West. Now it's a sort of stripped down version and a lot of Buddhists don't consider it to be true Buddhism. And I don't care necessarily because I know that it's helped me and I know that it's helped others. And I believe you that in the hospice center, the Zen hospice center, that people were helped by this as well in a very, in maybe the most important part of their lives. And the idea that it helped you as a volunteer, both with your mother and with these strangers. These were strangers you were sitting next to while they were dying every Saturday night for 6 or 7 years, right? Mm-hmm. That it helped you, that it made you happier, more fulfilled, and better prepared for your own death, alleviated your own death anxiety, which psychologists have been telling us for centuries that is the central anxiety that drives us to do all sorts of things. In fact, I just heard
everything.
I just heard Tara Brach, she's a well-known therapist and meditation.
Yeah.
Guru or something, but I was just listening to her. Her theory about death is that we have this overwhelming fear of death, which causes us to accumulate things, which causes us to despoil the earth. Now, I don't really love the political direction she goes in, but I do think that death is a constant anxiety for at least Westerners, and it does cause us to seek satisfaction or affirmation or pleasure in ways that we might not otherwise, to sort of fill in or avoid or distract us.
That's it.
I think distract actually, us from death.
I think it's actually worse than that. there's a well-established psychological school. It's called terror management theory. It emerged in the 70s before 9/11 and terrorism. So we hear the word terror now, all we can think of is terrorism. they named their field Terror Management Theory, TMT, talking about the terror of death. That's what they're referring to. And they first started doing these studies, and mortality salience is a technical term within the terror management theory field. And I'm talking about a field where there are thousands of published papers and dozens of PhDs in psychology around the country who would call themselves terror management theory advocates and researchers. And what they do is they will ratchet up your mortality salience in a research situation by showing you pictures of dead people or by, I mean, there's all sorts of ways that they do it. And they'll ask you things, you know, what do you think about this? Now, what do you think about this? And having your mortality salience peaked changes your attitude and changes your behavior. They've done studies of judges reading cases and saying how they would sentence those people. And some of the group had their mortality salience tweaked by reminders of death, and others didn't. And when you have your mortality salience tweaked, they issued more stern sentences, right? So this is, to your point, we when we're reminded of that stuff that we haven't been preparing ourselves for, it affects our attitudes and our behavior. In the cases of judges, they did harsher sentences. Even more so, to be reminded of something that you don't want to be reminded of is unpleasant. And when something unpleasant happens to you, you want to redress that. You want, technically, they would call it palliative compensation. You want to be compensated for that unpleasantness in a palliative way that makes you feel better. Well, one of the main ways that we can get palliative compensation is to strengthen our in-group bonds and push away the others. So it would be, well, you know, They can tell me about this kind of stuff all they want, but what really matters to me is like the bowling league. I mean, that's, I wake up in the morning and I wonder how I'm going to do it. And the guys on the team, you know, I just love them. They're so great. And people that don't like bowling, the heck with them. They can just rot in hell for all I care. Right now, I was being silly there. But that's the type of thing we do when we get unpleasantly stimulated. We remind ourselves of the tribe that we're part of, and we sort of distinguish ourselves from those other people. You see a lot of that going on today, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah, that's what I think that happens if you haven't been paying attention to your relationship with mortality at every step along the way. You'll look to be compensated for that unpleasant thing that life just reminded you of.
Yeah. You said you've moved past acceptance toward appreciation of death. And can you talk a little bit more about that?
I don't know if I can do it in a way that's not a cliche. I mean, it's just sort of obvious. Anybody that really has thought about this very much realizes that, well, when I speak to high school kids and I say something like, you know, what happens if me and everybody like my age could live forever? The first thing a high school kid say, well, you need to get out of my way. I mean, there won't be anything for me to do. So that's a problem. But the real point is that if you have unlimited time, there's no reason to do anything now. I mean, it's kind of an obvious thing. The fact that our life has not only a finite limit to it, but a finite limit that you don't really know what it is. Throughout your life, people say to you, don't get any attachments, man. That's really going to hang you up. If you get attached to things and expectations, you got to go into things with no expectations. Then they invent this thing called life expectancy. Right. The life expectancy of Americans is, you know, 78.2. Actually, the life expectancy of Americans has been going down over the last few years, which is amazing. Yeah. It's the first, I think, developed country where that's ever happened.
Driven by white men, right?
A lot of dying. Suicide. It's not just white men. There is also, ethnic minority women, and there's a lot of components to that. But yes, suicide is a big reason that I believe the life expectancy is going down. But in any event, I think one way that people play the denial game is to go, well, they say the normal thing is like 78, and I'm normal, so like I'll probably make it 78, and I'm like 38 right now, so you know, I'll start thinking about this 20, 30 years.
Right.
That's not it's not totally dumb when you think about it that way, except for the fact that we don't really know.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. And you know that you don't know, you know?
Right. So prepare for it every day.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, I like it. A lot, actually. I think it's got revolutionary potential, and I mean that. I think that it could change everything, not just the way we think about death, but the way we think about life.
Yeah, that's the idea.
That's right. Okay, so let's get back to your earlier history here. So you became involved in the anti-war movement.
As a student, you know, marching when it was time to march. Yeah, right.
And the secret war, the bombing of Cambodia was especially powerful.
That
to
really
you.
Just drove everybody out, including me. Yeah.
And I remember in my house, there was a poster on the wall that said, end the air war now, bring the monster down. And it had pictures of Vietnamese and Cambodian peasants with a dragon dropping bombs on them, dropping bombs on them in 1970, 1971. The secret war, Nixon's bombing and all that. That was... sort of maybe the most galvanizing moment for the anti-war movement at the time. And you became, I mean, you became sort of attached to Cambodia in some ways then. I mean, you started to think about it and you started to become concerned, I guess, in some...
Well, I more put it as Thad knows, Cambodia is going to come back into my life story later. and certainly I was aware of Cambodia, as a lot of people were. And I'm a student of history. So, you know, I knew something about Cambodia. And do you want me to talk about how it came back, or how do you want to play it out?
Let's so you've been involved in a pretty major project in Cambodia for the last several years.
Yeah.
And it's become a big part of your life in addition to your work on Death and Dying. And I just think it's interesting that it came full circle. And of course, nobody knows about death and dying more than Cambodians.
Well, see, that is the point. Yeah.
And
they have come back from death as a country has come back from death.
It was year zero, Pol Pot declared after he killed, you know, how much of the population. So yes, I mean, it was a dead country in some ways by the late 1970s. Right. And you became, I just think it's interesting that you came back to Cambodia, you know, having your political awakening was around Cambodia and the mass death being visited on that country then. And now you're returning in the last several years and watching a country rebuild from that and trying to inject life into a dead place.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And it happened because one of my best friends, one of the people that we did our, you know, broadband community cable TV stuff with way back in the 1970s, mm-hmm. You know, after we went our different ways at the end of that, the years went by and this guy, his name is Al Morgan, met up with a Cambodian refugee. So just to tell the story quickly is that maybe one of the worst, who knows to compete with worst, there's been a lot of worst, but one of the just a terrible genocide happened between 1975 and 1979 in Cambodia. A group within the country, the Khmer Rouge, in some ways similar to like the North Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. They were from the more mountainous, less developed, not the city part of the country. And they just came pouring out of there. I could talk a lot more about who the Khmer Rouge were, but
please do. A lot of people don't know this story anymore. Go ahead.
Well, a number of Cambodia was a French colony, part of Indonesia, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia. And the French didn't do anything to develop it. I think they might have built one school in the whole country. They developed Vietnam a lot, but Cambodia, not so much. But there were some of the smartest people in Cambodia that went to that one high school, and some of them were able to go and be educated in Paris. And those were the ones that became Pol Pot and the leaders of the... So these were intellectuals.
Just like Ho Chi Minh.
That's right. And they became communists mm-hmm. when they saw kind of the bigger worldview there in Paris. They probably, I don't know...
You have to go to college to be a communist.
That's
because
right.
It requires a lot of reading of difficult texts.
Yep, and indeed, the whole thing, the comprehensives and whatnot. And then they went back and they found, you know, poor people from the most rural, undeveloped parts and convinced them that, you know, they had legitimate grievances and that they should get organized and fight for what was rightfully theirs. And they did. They led an army of a lot of them were just, you know, young boys, teenage boys, you know. Now, this is the time of the Cultural Revolution, too. They got, where'd they get their support in their arms? They got it from China. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a part of a bigger picture going on at that time. And they won. They just completely, you know, you've probably seen The Killing Fields with the American reporters.
The movie and the book.
You know, that's right. Yep, you know, going on to helicopters just as the, and it's just an amazing scenario of a conquering army driving in their jeeps into the city, down the streets of a city. You just don't see that kind of thing anymore, you know? And then to the remaining civilians in that city, they said, okay, you know, time to leave. You're all going to leave. Yep. They emptied the city. Mm-hmm. This was a city that at that time, the population might've been a million or so, but there was probably at least 3 million people in Phnom Penh at that time, because they'd all come there to get away from the Khmer Rouge. And 3 million people were walked out of the city, you know, under armed guards into the countryside, and some of them just dropped and died there, and some of them made it off to what then became work camps, and they were put to work on crazy projects. We've decided we're going to build a dam here, so just start digging. You know, I mean, it was just insane. But the real death and dying part was that the Khmer Rouge knew that their biggest threat at totally controlling this new country of theirs, and as you say, they started the calendar at year zero. They called the new country Anka, and they killed as much as they could all of the intellectuals and the artists. If you had glasses, you were killed, kind of thing, because those are the people that were going to be the biggest threat to them. The young man who my friend Al met had come from a musical family, a family of performers. He was 10 years old when the Khmer Rouge came in 1975, and they just kind of spared him to work, to put bodies into big graves at night and to do whatever they told him to do. And for 4 years, then he was in some hellish work camp where people would just, you know, work until they dropped 12 hours a day. And then they would come back at night and hear political lectures. It's unbelievable to see these stories. Well, who ended up driving out the Khmer Rouge was the Vietnamese. In 1979, the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia and pushed the Khmer Rouge into one little tiny section in the northwest corner of the country. It effectively now Vietnam ran it from 79 into the 90s. People, it was a Vietnam holding occupied territory for at least 11 years. I think it was 92 that the UN said, we got it. This is, let's get serious here. Let's have real elections and whatnot. And it's a really complicated story. But in the early 90s, they had elections. Some guy named Hun Sen, who had been a Khmer Rouge, but then joined up with the Vietnamese. He's kind of a Vietnamese guy now, and he is still the ruler of Cambodia. By the mid and late 90s, a lot of the Cambodian diaspora, people when they leave for France or America, two biggest places in America that people came from Cambodia were Lowell, Mass, and Long Beach, California. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they don't want to think about that anymore. But there are some people that I want to go back, I want to help, I want to save. And this guy, this 10-year-old guy who my friend met, Arn Chornpond.
Who's quite famous. Can you talk about him for a second?
Yeah, he is now, well, he was 10 years old, then went through 4 years of the Khmer Rouge. When the Vietnamese came, the Khmer Rouge would give their prisoners weapons and said, get in the front line and fight those South Vietnamese. And so Arn, all of a sudden, from being a forced laborer, and now he's like, you know, 13, 14 years old, and they put a gun in his hand. He's supposed to shoot at people, and he was doing that. And one time he looked around, there's no one else around, and he just left and made it to a refugee camp. To say it's improbable that he survived, but he did, and got adopted by an American, and went to high school in Vermont, from the hell of the Khmer Rouge and the refugee camp in Thailand, you know, in Vermont. And he then went to college at Brown, and I believe finished at Providence College, and then went to Lowell to work with young people from Cambodia, you know, that were having troubles. That's where he met my friend. And his determination was to go back, find any surviving artists, and then use and to save the artistic and cultural traditions of Cambodia, and use that to help people find strength, find pride in their heritage, to start coming back from the dead and rebuild Cambodia. And that's what he did.
And the organization is called?
It's now called Cambodian Living Arts. Cambodian Living Arts. Yeah.
Yes.
For the first, you know, 3 or 4 years, it was just finding some guy that was one of the last few people who was a master musician of something, and he'd been pretending to be a barber for the last however many years, and they'd put young people around him and have him teach them what to do, and, you know, and the years went by, and they got support from Americans and from foundations and kept doing their work. Now they are a thriving organization, maybe, you know, certainly one of the preeminent arts organizations in the country. They perform every night traditional dances and music. But most particularly what I'm now involved with is their kind of outreach arm is a really cool, you know, back to the merry pranksters in the 60s again.
Yeah.
They call it the Khmer Magic Music Bus. Yeah. And it's a really cool painted up bus, and they go out to remote villages all over Cambodia and perform. They play traditional music with traditional instruments, but also, you know, bring it upbeat and have guitars and amplifiers and just show everybody a good time, but showing them their music that many of them haven't seen for two generations. Mm-hmm. Old people just break down. Mm. It's just so emotional for them to then to see the Kim played again or whatnot.
That's an instrument.
That's right. Because they haven't seen it since their childhood or something like that.
A traditional instrument.
That's
in Cambodia.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So really, really moving. And when I first went to Cambodia back in 2016, I think it was, with my friend Al, who had been there many times helping to form Cambodian Living Arts. And then we went back together and we traveled around Cambodia with Arn. And I had my new 360 video camera. Wow. At that time, 360 video, meaning that you could take a full view of the video front, back, around. There's no getting away from the camera. And you could put that in a VR headset and feel immersed in wherever that video was. Yeah. Well, I started recording video around Cambodia. And then I showed it to some of the Cambodian Living Arts people in Phnom Penh. And they were like, wow, this is a neat way to show what we're doing and to show Cambodia. We don't quite know what to do, but maybe there's something there. And so I've been going back and working with them how to record dance and how to record the performances they put out in the villages. I've interviewed people and trying to figure out the best way to use this. And I've sort of come up with some ideas about how to use it for fundraising and whatnot. So I feel like I have a project supporting an arts organization using a country's traditional culture to, as you said, to help bring them back from the dead.
Yeah.
It's really keeping me feel quite involved and engaged fully in my retirement. It's very difficult to do that. It's easy to get a volunteer job where you just come and show up and do something, but it's using my technical videography skills, my creativity, but more importantly, my people skills. Mm-hmm. I'm learning. I'm working with people. I'm training them how to do this. I'm creating a team that we can work together with, in Cambodia, and it's. And then learning how to figure out the organizational dynamics of Cambodian Living Arts, there. So it's just been a great project for me.
Yeah, you've been a new media pioneer your entire career. So in the early 1970s, you were thinking about what became the internet already, and you were thinking about the potentials for it, the possible pitfalls of it. And then you had a longer career, which we haven't talked about, where you were doing always sort of the new media thing. You were doing CD-ROMs. You were producing CD-ROMs when it was new.
Yep.
Right. You did all sorts of... Then you did online courses. You did MOOCs, essentially. You did mm-hmm. online learning
yep.
early on, sort of similar to what RU is now. But and now virtual reality and 360 cameras and all this, you're immersed in this. You're 70 years old, man. Hardly anyone's doing this. I mean, it's quite amazing the energy you have and how these things have carried through your career, this interest in death and dying. By the way, we forgot to mention that your mother was a hospice volunteer.
No, I think I did mention that, but yeah.
Oh, you did. I'm sorry. Yeah. So that was an earlier inspiration. But
yeah.
So death and dying and caring for people, being a part of your life, the Buddhism became a part of your life. And then Cambodia, I think, is so interesting, right? Because that became central in your life too early. And then lately, where death has been paramount, is sort of characteristic in a sense of Cambodia. And you're coming back and using new media, brand new media that's almost not even out yet, to bring life maybe back to a country that was so dead.
And one of the real characteristics of VR is that concept of presence, is that when you put on the headset, your brain is tricked into thinking you are in that place.
Yeah.
So you could say that, whatever the life is when the Khmer Magic Music Bus goes out into the village and people celebrate and they're so happy, we can have people feel that they're there.
Yes.
So that's really, every other form of media that I've been using, and you're right, I'm drawn to new media. I want to use it and figure out what it can do, but there's always a distance. There's you, and then there's the media. There's mm-hmm. the TV screen, the film screen, whatever it is, but you're immersed in VR, and it's a different thing.
In your apartment in Seattle several days ago before I came to Orcas Island to visit you here, you put a headset on me, a VR headset on me, and this is the first time I've ever done VR. And I was in Cambodia in some building. Was it like a temple?
Yeah, it was a temple. Yeah, it was a Buddhist temple up near the Thai border. Yep.
There you go. Because I was inside this Buddhist temple, and I was inside it. And there were people in front of me speaking, and there were people behind me taking pictures and speaking. And there was music being played to the left of me, and there were other people to the right of me. And yep. I think you were in the room too, taking pictures. And I was turning around and I was looking up and I could see the ceiling and I looked down, I could see the floor, which really, that really drove it home to me. And I felt completely immersed in this thing. And then there was another video you showed me, a VR video, which was just of you talking to a Cambodian girl at a table, I think at a restaurant.
Yeah.
And the camera was sort of in between the two of you. Right. So I turned my head to the left, I'd look at you talking, and I'd turn my head to the right and look at her talking. And I was looking directly in your faces. You were right in front of me.
Yeah.
And I'd look up and I'd see the ceiling of the restaurant, look down, see the table, look all around, see the other patrons in the restaurant. I was in there and I was thrilled. It also made me think, why don't we have podcasts like Unregistered with a 360 video, or maybe a couple of 360 videos, so that people can be even more intimately involved in that conversation that we have, where they're already intimately involved. It's in their ears, it's in their heads. They hear my voice, they hear the guest voice. But if you could actually be there like a fly in a way and be able to fly around, not on the wall, but actually a fly that can fly around, which is what 360 and VR offers you. You can be, you can look at me, you can look at the guest, you can go around the table, you can go above the table. It is, I think, the future. And this is another reason that I'm hanging out with you a lot these days, because we're talking a lot about the potentials of VR, both for Unregistered and Renegade University and for the world at large. I think it's going to be the thing, and I'm really excited to at least begin to explore that.
Yeah, I'll say a couple things. I mean, just to directly respond to what you're saying about, you know, the interviews, obviously one of the great things about podcasting is that how you can give your attention to other things while you're listening to the interview. Mm-hmm. So I'm with you, and I think we have a lot to learn about how to offer that option. I think the 360 interview should be an option, just like a lot of podcasts now, the YouTube channel is an option. And I almost never listen to podcasts on the YouTube channel. But when I'm, you know, cleaning up my office or working out or folding laundry or whatever it is, listening to a podcast, and something will come, I want to see that guy, and I'll go look at it, right? And so so it's an option that I always know is there, and I avail myself of it sometimes. I think the idea of a 360 version of the podcast might be the same way. Mm-hmm. And it might be that there's segments of the podcast that are the one that you really want to experience in the 360, and the other you can listen to and fold your laundry. You know, I don't know. We got to figure all that out.
Yeah.
No one really knows what the form factor is for VR. Does someone want to have their VR headset on for an hour? Probably not. Mm. But maybe it should be their choice. Mm. So if I have a fantastic hour-long interview, should I divide it into natural 8-minute chunks and then let people say, I think I'll pause now and take this off, or I'll just continue? I don't know. That's all to be figured out. Certainly the intimacy of your presence there changes, you know, the nature of how you experience it. The other thing I just want to say, just the way that this all ties together, is that dying and those last days before you actually die have a huge VR component in there too.
Yes.
And there's a lot of areas, a lot of, as they say, use cases in the VR world about VR. But one of the big ones is, but again, there's a great way this can be used, and there's a way that it's not the way I would go for. So will VR be used to, like the Matrix, really, you know, just put a VR headset on the old people in the nursing home, you know, let them watch, you know, Tweety and Sylvester cartoons, and that's it. You know, we've now taken care of them. The other thing that you didn't quite say in your first exposition about VR is, not only can I make content either from video or by creating a fully synthetic universe with software like Unity and then put you into that, but it can be a social experience also. So there are apps in VR, just like you have apps on your phone, and an app can be a place where you go that's set up to be a recreation room for people's avatars to play together in VR, or a meditation facility to meditate with people in VR, or a workspace with white spaces so that a working team can work together in VR. Well, how that ties, obviously, to old age would be that, what are we going to do with old people? Are we just going to, like, distract them and warehouse them? Or are we going to let them still connect with people socially?
Yes.
There's no reason that someone lying in bed that has any cognitive facilities up should be able to have a talk with someone who's not there and feel that they're really present with that person, you know?
Yes.
So VR can be a way to connect people people who don't have the physical functionality that much to be able to go out and connect with anybody anymore. But with VR, we can do it. Is that the way it's going to be used? I hope so.
We can die alone, but we don't have to.
Correct.
And especially now.
Right. And VR can be used as a way to isolate people in their own little matrix thing, or to connect people and die feeling connected to the people that you want to be with. So, yeah.
Death can and maybe should be, if we're going to be happy about it, a social experience.
You certainly want as much, you know, you want, when you are a dying person, the social experience that you want.
That's right.
You know, when you want to connect with someone, you want it. When you don't want to, you don't want to.
That's right. So. Yeah, yeah. And which brings me to another point you made, I think it was yesterday, maybe the day before. You drew a distinction between compassion and empathy. So when you said you were a volunteer in these hospice centers, you felt compassion for the people you were working with, not necessarily empathy. And how do you define those things?
Well, a few of both. And again, I don't know if this is semantics, and maybe I'm not going to use the word exactly right, but here's how I think about it, which is that, okay, I should go back and say probably the first big thought concept that's come out about VR is this notion of it being an empathy machine, that you can create a virtual experience through the eyes of someone else. The big first famous one was a 10-year-old girl named Sidra in a refugee camp. And a VR was made of her life in this refugee camp. And then it was shown in headsets to a bunch of wealthy donors who were going to contribute to it. And they felt that presence in the refugee camp through the VR. And they gave, you know, 10 times more than was predicted. So immediately it was said that they felt empathy because of the VR. That's why they gave that money. And the meme was born. The guy behind that then did a TED talk on it. And it was in that TED talk that the empathy machine meme was born. I think it's sort of true, but it's not quite that simple. Mm-hmm. I think part of it was the newness of it. I think that the wealthy donors had their minds blown, and that was how they said thank you, by giving a lot of money. I don't necessarily think, I think what VR does is create experiences. If you do them in a certain way and present them in a certain way, it can create empathy too. Is empathy what you always want to get people to donate to your cause? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, you got to look carefully at these things. So to me, empathy means I'm me, you're you, and I have some sense of what's going on inside you. But it's definitely, it's a me other sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We're two separate things, and I have this insight into your mind. And maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. And some people will say that what VR did in the case of that refugee camp is create, I'm just going to make up a term, place empathy. You really felt what it was like to be in that refugee camp. No kidding. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't qualify it. But did the wealthy donors in New York process that feeling the same way Sidra did? Well, of course not, because they knew they were going to go home to something else where it was Sidra's home, you know? So feeling what it's like is different than that being your entire frame of reference in the way you process everything. Right. Okay, so that's important. Compassion to me means a feeling of deep connection, or better yet, I might as well be you.
Yeah.
And the story that I told you about that, where it just came through to me like electricity going through my body, was a time that I was sitting with a guy who was maybe 10 years older than me. He wasn't very responsive. He wasn't doing anything. I was sitting there. He was breathing. I was touching him. He knew I was there. And I was just sitting quietly. And the guy who is the manager of Zen Hospice at that time sort of came by the door and saw me and said, "Oh, Tom, I see you're there with him. And did you know that he had once been a Zen Hospice volunteer, you know, like you?" And seeing that, hearing that, it just, that's when the charge went through me, because it was like, that is actually me in the bed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometime that literally will be me in the bed sometime down the road. And it might as well be now, Zen Hospice, whatever, you know. And so that to me is compassion. I really felt like I was him.
Yeah.
But again, I'm not saying one is better than the other and one is better for fundraising, whatever. But they're different things.
Right.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, you were very close to being that guy not long ago. You were diagnosed with lymphoma, right?
Yep.
And you, for quite a while there, thought you may very well die at any moment.
There was definitely a chance of that, yep.
And,
didn't know.
And you are technically in remission,
right?
But you don't call it that.
No, I like to say I have cancer.
Yeah. Even though there is no cancer in your body, as far as we know.
They can't find the cancer in my body. The cancer cells are beyond our imaging technology's capability at this time.
Yeah. Right, but you assume it's in there.
Yeah.
Okay. So you assume you're dying.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. And you're 70 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And last December, is this right? Your wife was diagnosed with cancer as well.
Yep, breast cancer.
That's right. And she had treatment, and now she is in also technically in remission.
Correct.
How do you both view your mortality now? And how do you view this, all of this now? Mm-hmm. Has that changed anything?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, she processes things differently than I do. I'm the sort of person who immediately upon, as I kind of told in my story, when receiving this diagnosis and finding out cancer was not going to just be an abstract part of my life, I just jumped in with both feet every direction I could to get involved in the whole field and the whole feeling and the whole subject. And that's the way my wife is. She takes her time. She does a bit more work internally. And it was tricky because I think the trickiest thing to comment about it is that as you've tried to say, I'm supposedly an expert on this, you know, and here's my wife, you know, the person who's the most central to my existence. And there was times when I was really able to help her. There was times when I probably wasn't the right guy, you know, kind mm-hmm. of thing. So it actually, in some ways, we're really close. We've been married for a long, long time. I really love her. But it takes a community to raise a child. You know, she needed more than just me, mm-hmm. you know, to help her with this too. Mm-hmm. And would she say, I would clearly say that cancer has been a net plus in my life. I have no question. Yeah. I've often said, if I could go back and figure out the thing that made me get CLL in the first place, I wouldn't change it. I'm glad
CLL was the
happened.
Name of your leukemia.
Chronic
leukemia.
Lymphatic leukemia, something like right. that. Yeah. I'm glad that it happened to me. Hmm. I do not believe my wife would say that. Hmm. She feels it showed her strengths about herself that she didn't know she had. And she's better than ever now. And she's feeling great about herself, but I doubt that she would say it's been a net plus in her life, you know, kind of thing. I don't know. That's just me, I guess.
But, you're a weirdo, man. What can I tell you? Well, I got to say, so we had to take a pause in the middle of this podcast so that you could go greet your grandchild who had just arrived on the island here.
Grandchildren.
Well, I just saw one. But yeah. So what Tom did, who's 70 years old, let's remember this. And he says he has cancer and is dying. Remember this. Tom was running full speed across the grass, picking up his grandkid and throwing him up over his shoulders and playing with him on the swing and roughhousing looking like a 20-year-old out there. I lived in New York City for 17 years, which means that I walk really fast and I'm a lot younger than you are. And we've been walking around this island, taking hikes and walks for a few days now. And I have a hard time keeping up with you. I have never been around someone so alive in my life, not to mention a 70-year-old. I have never been around a 70-year-old who's even close to being as alive as you are, full of energy, full of creativity, interests, activity, interested in people, things, constantly moving, constantly exploring. You're in Cambodia twice a year, and you stay there for months at a time, in Phnom Penh, which is one of the harder cities to live in the world. At your age and doing all this, it's remarkable. I, you know, I'm sure you've been like this your whole life, very energetic person, but I have to believe that you were able to run across that grass with the joy of what looked like a child just now to me, in part because of your acceptance or what you've done with your own mortality.
Yeah, no, I have no doubt about it. Yeah, I mean, it's...
not acceptance. Sorry, you said appreciation.
Appreciation.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, you're appreciating death and you can appreciate life now.
Yeah, yeah.
In that way.
No, I wake up every day and you got to fill the day and do things, you know, mm-hmm. and I want to do things that have fun. So I don't regard going to Cambodia as like scary and I'm trying to prove myself or, you know, whatever it is. I like it. Mm-hmm. I like to do things that I like, you know, so.
Yeah. And you just keep doing them.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
Day by day. Tom, you're an inspiration and a model and a great teacher and a great friend. And I want to thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great talking.
Great. Thank you. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To get your tickets for the Unregistered live event in Brooklyn on July 16th with Nick Gillespie and Dave Smith, go to thaddeusrussell.com.